I think he was discouraged by the reception the book had, and it didn't create the dialogue that he was seeking. He did send it to various people, like he sent it to the French philosophes. And I don't know what their reaction was to it. It did get circulated, however, because there's a curious passage by a Unitarian minister in around Salem, Massachusetts, a guy named William Bentley, who was a friend of Thomas Jefferson. In fact, Thomas Jefferson offered Bentley the presidency of the University of Virginia, so they were really close friends. And Bentley had visited one of his parishioners and had loaned him the book, and the parishioner died. And it became a scandal in Salem because they claimed that Bentley was trying to convert him to infidelity because of this horrid book. And it really became quite a scandal. And so it was a book that was secretly passed around. Now, did Jefferson read it? I think so. I'm pretty sure he did, because he was pretty close with Bentley. And there's certain passages in Jefferson's own journals where he talks about reason being the only oracle of man, and it just sounds pretty familiar. So I think that that this book was circulated among, although they did not openly espouse it, because there was a feeling among the founding fathers that it was best to leave well enough alone, that we don't want the whole country becoming godless, and because they felt that this is a type of philosophy that really wasn't for the masses, whereas Ethan Allen thinks that it is. They felt that really, if you pull the rug out from under the masses, in terms of religious faith and their comfortable conceptions about life, that the ensuing world would be chaos, sort of like the French Revolution. And that's why they got very mad at Thomas Paine. Now, Thomas Paine was a hero and was well known to all of these early founding fathers because of common sense. And they discouraged him, particularly Franklin, from ever publishing his religious views. But he figured, well, by 1794, it was late enough in the game, and he was getting old, that he would. So in England, he published The Age of Reason, which, as I mentioned in the introduction, is very similar, although it's even more iconoclastic than Ethan Allen. And sure enough, he went from being a hero to being a pariah, and he died pretty well an outcast. It just wasn't anything that they really wanted to popularize, and so they were mad at Thomas Paine for doing that. And yet a book like Reason, the Only Oracle of Man was passed around in and read, I'm sure, by these founding fathers, but just not put out there for the public. So if we look at the essence of the book, what is he really saying here? He's saying that the masses of mankind, even despite all the progress that we've made in terms of sciences, and he mentions astronomy and geography and history and all of these, have reached a degree of perfection, which is doubtful. I mean, because we're talking about, 18th century science, but still, for him, it was pretty good. But in the meantime, he said, we haven't made a comparable advance in terms of religion, because mankind is carried away by a torrent of superstition, he felt. And that it behooves all true lovers of nature, philosophical friends of nature, he says something like that, in order to come to the rescue of poor benighted mankind and liberate them from their delusions in this regard and teach them true religion, which he felt was the direct revelation of God through nature. That's why it's called natural religion. It doesn't mean that they were nudists that went out and hugged trees. It is that, and he asked the question, if God gave us this original revelation through nature, why do we need any secondary revelations? If that was good enough, that's sort of the question that he asked. And then he says, if the first revelation wasn't good, how can we trust the second? How can we trust revealed religion? And so he's saying that the essence of natural religion is the practice of morality. And curiously enough, you would think that, well, maybe if you had this and you removed other injunctions such as, sacred scriptures and laws as guides of conduct, you would end up with a chaotic kind of morality. Just the opposite. It becomes very clear that as part of his understanding of natural law, the basic commandments are included, such as thou shalt not covet and thou shalt not kill. Those are two that he mentions. These are natural laws that are, in a sense, written in our hearts that we can break, because you can break any law. You know, you can go out and speed in your car. I mean, the consequences, you might get a ticket or you might have an accident and hurt somebody, but you can do it. We have that. So these are laws that we don't have to abide by, but the true, in this case, philosophic friend of nature would, because that expresses morality in the highest degree, which is, he says, the greatest function that we can have on earth. So, and then all of this is against this background of a fundamental stoicism, which comes out in the chapter on physical evils, where he says that certain physical evils are just inherent in nature, and it's part of our animal being, as he put it, in order to that forces us to experience pain and suffering and dissolution. And there's nothing we can do about it. It's just, we can't, he says, you can't have the mountains without the valleys, you know, you can't have the light without the dark. It's just part of the whole, we can't explain it. We can't explain why, because God is basically inscrutable. But this is part of God's plan. And what we need to do is practice virtue, because that's the only thing that really is going to allow us to transcend the evils of nature, which, and also the moral evils. He says, you know, if we only had to deal with physical evils, that's bad enough, but we have to deal with moral evil as well, such as killing, lying, the seven deadly sins, and all of the mess that people get themselves in. We got to deal with that as well. So the only way to deal with all of these is to maintain a stoic attitude towards life. Avoid encumbrances, he says. Now, that would be like overt possessions and encumbrances. And wait patiently the few years that God allots us. He says it isn't very long. And soon, the wonder, the beauty of the other world will be revealed to us. He doesn't have any concept of hell here at all. It's implicit that we, after this life, go on to another existence. Now, this is where he makes a leap of faith, and he says that in the first part, he's going to stick everything according to reason in this book. But then he gets to the chapter, which I claim is the fundamental chapter on immortality, and he makes a huge leap of faith, because he said, it is not beyond the powers of God to supply us with other modes of sensation upon death. Well, where do we get that? I mean, that seems like, you know, he's reaching for something. But even though he claims that he's not a Christian right up front, it's almost to me like some of these Zen monks that claim they're not Buddhist. You know, he's practicing a radical form of Christianity, I think, because the fundamentals of morality and immortality of the soul and adherence to natural law are there. They're there, clearly. So what he's differentiating himself from is Orthodox or Calvinistic Christianity, and also Catholicism as well. I mean, but I think of him as a very radical and somewhat eccentric practicer of Christianity, because a lot of the thoughts here, he only used the Bible and the dictionary. Those are his only two sources that he claims. He claims he never read the deist, and he's not beholden to any man as far as these views go. So I think that view that I'm not a Christian except mere baptism makes me one. I think we need to take that with a grain of salt there, because of the importance he places on morality. If he said anything goes, there's no heaven, forget about it, you know, eat, drink, and be merry, and live for today, then I would say probably isn't. But because he views this life as a preparation for the next life, and because he places this great stress on morality, I would say that I would actually argue that he's at least a closet Christian there, of a Unitarian stripe. I mean, the type of Christianity in the Roman period that would be called Arianism, which is the view of Jesus as a human prophet rather than Son of God. But there's a lot here, and the reason I put this book out in your hands is I was hoping you would have some questions that maybe I could respond to. I'm not espousing, you understand, this is my disclaimer, I'm not saying that what he says is what I believe, but I think it's a great inducement to dialogue, to have some passages like this to talk about.
What you said just now sounded to me a little bit like some writings of Plato, as far as the soul and this stoicism kind of thing.
Yeah, oh, definitely. And in fact, it's crossed my mind that, with his, I think of Plato's analogy of the cave, what Ethan Allen is trying to do is get people out of the cave, to loosen the chain so they're not looking at the shadows anymore. They're looking at true light, which is found in nature. Get them out of the cave. So yeah, I there's definitely an element of Platonism in here, and also this positivity about the soul's immortality, which Plato had as well, more than Aristotle. Yeah. I think that's a. And I don't know if Ethan Allen ever read Plato. I doubt it, because his educational career was cut short when he was young. He was supposed to go to Yale, and his father died young, and so he had to take over the family. He was the eldest. He had, I don't know how many brothers, 6 or 7 brothers. And they had the unfortunate thing of having funny names like Zeman and Heman. Zeman.
I know, I thought that was pretty funny.
And Heman.
I'm trying to join the boys.
But the two brothers that are the famous ones had the best names, Ira and Ethan Allen. Those are great names, you know. And those are the ones we remember. There were some of them that were black sheeps of the family and stuff, but it was quite a family. I mean, it wasn't a remarkable family. Ira didn't really have much interest in philosophy of religion, and I think that he thought Ethan was a little bit, wacko for going at it the way he did. And then Ira ended up as a pauper and he's in a pauper's grave in Philadelphia. So it shows the wheel of fortune turning here, because at a time when he was, at his peak, in Vermont, he was probably the most powerful man in the state of Vermont. Around the time the University of Vermont was founded and Vermont became a state, Ira Allen was right up at the peak. But he didn't end that way. That's why Aristotle said you can never judge a man as truly happy until he's completed his whole life cycle.
This represents what percentage of the original Bible? For example, the one that you saw in Barry.
Well, that's 500 pages long.
Pardon? Yes. I was just wondering how you distilled all this to this,
I'd have to actually show you the original to see. The chapters here are pretty much the same titles of the chapters that he had, like The Cause of Idolatry, only that would be a chapter of maybe 20 pages there. And what I did, quite frankly, I took the sentences that I thought were memorable and I wrote them down. That's how I did it. Mm-hmm. And I did leave a lot out. He has many chapters on miracles in the Old Testament, which I felt were not that interesting. And anybody that's read Thomas Paine's The Age of Reason has already read all of that. Mm-hmm. I actually think, now this is, I don't know if Thomas Paine, I'm not saying he plagiarized, but I think he read Reason, the Only Oracle of Man, too, before he wrote The Age of Reason, but mm-hmm. I don't know.
It's so interesting that knowing what Ethan Allen was like and how he died, and, he died, he died coming back across the lake on a sleigh. Literally on a sleigh, and there's some thought that he was drunk out of his mind.
Well, I've researched that a little bit, and I'm actually kind of doubtful about that story. I mean, I know he died coming back. Yeah. He went up to get hay for his farm. Of course, the farm is out here in the Intervale, and it happened February 13th, so just recently, in 1789, which I think is kind of interesting because it's the same year as the big French Revolution, he fell off the sled. Yeah, I think he had a stroke, actually. I mean, he might have had... He did imbibe a bit.
He may very well have had a stroke, but he also was a big drinker.
Yeah, I know that.
You know, so, I mean, I'm just talking about he was a larger-than-life person and a self-promoter. And, mm-hmm. you know, and what struck me in this is that, you know, his belief in God.
Yeah.
You know, just is on every page. Oh, I know it's a distillation, but I assume that it's a distillation because it's God is mentioned so frequently, and
all
his absolute conviction
yep.
that there is this rational God.
Yep. Yep. And confidence that life is good and that we have so much to learn. He absolutely, there's a passage I didn't include in this where he talks about the afterlife as being a place where we continue our learning and discourse on all of the things about the universe, but then know it truly. Here we can only know it as, you know, Paul says, you know, through a glass darkly, sort of, but there we will see it clearly. And he couldn't wait. He even has that passage where he says, if you could see for a second the wonders that await us, it would embitter us in terms of this present life. So, I mean, it was, death is not something he feared. I mean, either as a warrior or as a philosopher, he thought he was sure he was headed for a better life. I mean, and that struck me as unusual, too, because when you read the first part, you would say, well, I bet he's dubious about immortality because it wouldn't meet the rational criteria that he had already established. But
it's
he does make this
statement of faith.
He mm-hmm. makes a leap of faith. Yeah. Yeah. And I just find that fascinating because
seems so contrary to everything else that he says.
Well, it's also given a lot of his recklessness.
Yeah.
He was a pretty reckless guy.
He was.
Ticonderoga yeah. worked, but it was reckless, and Montreal didn't work, and it was more reckless, and there a lot of other, you know, his rabble-rousing, and his fulminations against the New York legislature, and mm-hmm. I mean, you know, he was pursued as a criminal, and he was a pretty wild, crazy guy.
Yes.
So, you know, this whole focus on rationalism and God is really, really interesting.
Isn't it fascinating? That's why I say in the intro that he's a mystery. I mean, he's a multi-sided individual for sure. And a lot of it had to do with the influence of this Thomas Young, who is a little bit of a shadowy figure. He was a physician, an itinerant physician that he met in Connecticut, actually around Litchfield, Connecticut. And he inspired Ethan to talk about these subjects. And I just know that in his library, in Thomas Young's library, were these, like, Sir Herbert of Cherbury and Charles Blount, because Charles Blount wrote a book called The Oracles of Reason. So that's why this is not... Actually, there's not too much in this that's very original, to be quite frank. It's the way he put his stamp on it that makes it original. But I know that he imbibed these ideas from Thomas Young. And when he got out of prison, he got the manuscripts back from Thomas Young's widow. Because Thomas Young, I believe, died while Ethan was in prison in England. And when he came out, he sought her out and actually tried to do something with the state legislature to give a grant to... It didn't work out, as I recall reading the history, but to give a grant to Thomas Young's family. Because Thomas Young... not many people know this, but he's the first one to call Vermont, Vermont. I mean, he to the Continental Congress, he called this area Vermont for the first time. So in a way, he's the one that coined the name of our state. Mm. Yeah, that's a little known fact. I tell you, I got so fascinated with this because every time I would pursue something, it would lead to another thing that would get very interesting and go, but I guess I have that nature. I'm a little, maybe... I don't know, bookish or something, but I get very fascinated in these topics. You have?
No, I'm just the quote here. Now, I didn't get this yesterday, so I'm reading it now. But on page 15, where he in what you've summarized. He, in the third paragraph, talks about sensation.
Yes.
And then in the fourth paragraph, talks about death is the king of all of terrors, and then again talks about this new mode of sensation. So,
yeah.
So I'm just kind of fascinated that what you've distilled out of that chapter has everything to do with sensation. From a guy who, you know, spends the rest of the 500 pages writing about reason.
Pretty much. Although his, well, one of the boastful things he says right in the first part is that he's struck the outlines of a consistent system of philosophy here, which this really isn't. This is
right.
This is more like talk in a tavern, you know, and it's not a consistent system of philosophy at all. And I think that relates to the fact that he didn't have that formal education. Mm-hmm. Maybe if he did have that formal education, he never would have written this book, because somehow you're intimidated by authorities when you get that higher education, and he's mistrustful of them. As he says in the postscript, he says that the learned have used more ways to deceive the vulgar in mankind than they have to improve and inform us. And that rang true. That, you know, certain things that he says really ring true. But that is a very, and I worked on that chapter hard because I was working off the original. As I mentioned, that was not in the abridged version. The others I worked mainly off the abridged version, and then I went back and, like with the preface, the first part of the preface is from the original. That was left out of the abridged version. For what reason, I don't know. So the abridged version on the preface begins with, in the circle of my acquaintance, I've generally been called a deist, the reality of which I've never disputed. But it left out this beautiful first part, which says, in my youth, I was much disposed to contemplation. I mean, which I just couldn't understand. Of course, this abridgment was done in